Welcome to another episode of the Todos Mathematics for All podcast. We continue our mission to bring you conversations about mathematics education, social justice, and issues particularly pressing to communities of color.
I don't want to go in and observe and make judgments about interactions, or I want to make judgments about, like, well, this is what they're experiencing. I want to know from the mouth of babes, what is happening? How are they experiencing it? And I really wanted to, again, centralize them as the person who is the phenomena of their experience, the phenomenology of it all.
Carlos Nicolas Gomez, who goes by Nico, is a mathematician and assistant professor at Clemson University. When I made plans to talk with him, I knew he had recently been awarded a large, highly coveted National Science Foundation career grant. These grants are highly competitive, and they're awarded to pre-tenured folks to help get their careers in research off to a strong start. Nico's going to talk more about this grant later. However, the day before we were set to meet and talk at the Association for Mathematics Teacher Educators annual meeting this past February, Nico delivered a plenary address to the group that was both deeply personal and publicly resonant. In it, he shared a little bit of his own identity, as well as data that shows we still have a very long way to go to make professional organizations places and spaces where scholars of color are welcomed and central to the work. At one point, he showed some data that reflected how little has changed in terms of people of color in the mathematical sciences, despite many initiatives to increase their presence. He said something like, "Despite these initiatives, nothing has changed, and why would it? When most of these initiatives simply ask for more Black and brown bodies to be present, but few ask us to stay or even speak." I'll refer to his talk just a little bit in our discussion. In our conversation, we talked about Nico's own journey to becoming a mathematics teacher educator, his research agenda for his career project, and so much more. Let's get started. Nico, I'm so glad you're able to join us. Can you tell us a little, like, how did you get into math education and all that stuff?
Sure. It was mostly because I failed at being a musician. I graduated early from high school because I went into the counselor's office and was like, I hate my existence here. Get me out. And when I graduated, I knew I wanted to go just away. So I went to what is now Texas State University, but was Southwest Texas State University at the time, and tried to major in music, recording technologies, music recording technologies, I think it was the program. I failed miserably, failed really, really badly at it. I got rejected from the program once I auditioned, and then, but I was taking one of the core math classes there, and I wish I could remember the name of the mathematician who taught the course, but she just made me feel like I could do math really well, and that was the first time where I really started thinking about, like, my abilities in math. It just seemed kind of like an ebb and flow, just kind of thing that you do, but was the first person who made me feel really good about my ability. And so I decided to be a math major after that. And I went to the University of Texas in El Paso, and decided that I was going to teach. And that was the beginning of a very rocky road as a first year teacher in Winder-Barrow High School near Athens, Georgia. Because I didn't know I wanted to get my master's because I didn't feel prepared. Then the Jim Wilson at UGA was my kind of guide through the master's program. And eventually he convinced me that a doctorate would be a good run for me. And I trusted him. So I decided to go for it. And then I met wonderful people like Dorothy White and Anna Marie Connor there, Kevin Moore and all them. And they've kind of helped me in thinking really richly and deeply about some major issues and that I was having. So it just seemed like a good place to go.
Nice. So when you think about your identities and what you bring to mathematics, what are the experiences or the parts of yourself that you feel? Mm-hmm. I mean, and you already mentioned, like, failing as a musician, but I presume that you have a musician-ish identity. But, like, the other ones, you know, like where you come from, the language of your home. How do you think those things play a role into how you see the world mathematically?
I don't think I really recognized it fully until much later, how much it played a role. Immigrated to the U.S. when I was 4, and language was always a concern in our home because my parents knew the power of learning English and knowing English well. Mm-hmm. And having to repeat kindergarten because I couldn't speak English well enough to move on. Those kind of things were... Yeah.
Like your parents were told he's not moving on to first grade.
Right. And so I did a summer program. And then once the summer program, then they were like, probationary, we guess. And so they kind of got me started on first grade until they felt more comfortable because I didn't know English well enough at that point yet.
Really?
Yeah. At least, well, I have to be cautious here because that is the way my parents tell the story. So right. That's... I don't remember.
Have your parents ever said if you were raised in a time when the message they were getting was, don't speak Spanish at home?
Mm-hmm.
And have they ever shared, their thoughts on that?
So, I think this goes to say, and I can't remember her name, unfortunately, but there was some research about immigrant mothers. Mm-hmm. And about how they become anchors for the culture of where they come from. Mm-hmm. Especially if they're in a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my mother really fell into that role where she was the anchor to our culture, our Chilean culture.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we were in a majority Hispanic place, the fact that she felt like, no, we have to remember we are Chilean. We will always be Chilean. Here's what we do. Even though we're in this space, then eventually, it all kind of gets mixed, blended, salad bowl kind of thing. I think that does play a big role in this, in these feelings of, Nepatla, kind of otherness, in-betweenness. Mm-hmm. Of, I'm in a majority Mexican kind of culture, but I still at home and Chilean, so I'm Hispanic-ish, kind of. I don't know what kind of Hispanic I am. Because I grew up with this particular a strong Mexican culture, but at the same time at home, I have a strong Chilean culture. Uh-huh. So I'm Hispanic. This is the box that I check.
Right.
But it's a different kind of Hispanic.
Than
the predominant Hispanic culture. So not only are we othered in the fact that we're not the majority American culture, but then there's this other kind of other minority within the minority group.
Right.
Which was a strange place. And then, the fact that I present white makes this a little bit more complicated.
Do you describe yourself as presenting white? And I wanted to understand that a little bit more. Mm-hmm. I have heard the way people describe themselves. There's quite a variety, as we might expect, within the Latinx community. Mm-hmm. Because we become Latinx in the U.S. We are otherwise Chilean, Peruvian, mm-hmm. indigenous to our different locations. And so why do you say white as opposed to something like light-skinned Latino? There's a variety of ways people identify. Mm-hmm. What does it mean to you to say that you present white,
I think it's a reminder to myself of the responsibility that I have with the privilege that I look white. That when people see me, who don't know my name, who don't hear me speak Spanish, who don't hear about my background, they will assume whiteness on me. And for that fact, when I say presenting white, it's a reminder of the responsibility and privilege that I have due to that as I'm navigating the world.
Mm-hmm.
In order so that I make sure to take advantage of the fact that I have that privilege. And so I try, it's almost a reminder to myself due to the fact that, yes, I could say light complexion, but I feel that doesn't have that reminder of the privilege that I get.
I see. Thank you. That helps a lot. Tell us a little bit about what are you doing? Research, hobbies. You mentioned in your talk here at the Unnamed Conference that you're always interested in the stories from kids themselves as they describe their experiences, and you use, I'm thinking it's critical race theory, Latino critical theory. Could you talk about testimonial?
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about the work you're doing with that.
Sure. Actually, much of that work came from another project failing. Seemed to do well after failing.
But that's a wonderful message. We don't talk about failing enough, right? Like, to normalize this idea. Right. Like, well, I failed at that thing, so here's what I learned, and here's...
Right. Yeah, and maybe
with my hurt.
Maybe using the failing as a word is a bit too extreme. It's more of things fell apart in terms of a project. And so because it fell apart, I had to really reflect on like, okay, why am I doing this project? Am I doing this project because it's true to my roots? Because it's true to something that I have a real passion and desire for? Mm-hmm. Or am I doing this because academia convinced me that this gets funded, right? And then I came to the conclusion, no, I was doing it because I thought it would get funding. And I was almost relieved when it fell apart. Mm-hmm. I think it was still an interesting project. It was just kind of like, I breathed a sigh of like, oh, thank you, know? And so I started talking to a lot of people. A graduate student who was assigned to me, had a lot of conversations with like, okay, you know what? I want to start a new project. I really want it to be close to my roots. I'm in a predominantly white institution. Most of the schools here are predominantly white. I want to do something with the Latinx community. I want to feel my roots here, not just when I go home in El Paso, not just when I'm with my community. I want to feel my roots here where I do my work as well. Mm-hmm. And so we had long conversations, me and Stacy, lots of conversations about like, what do we want to do? Let's do this together. Since you're assigned to me anyway, let's collaborate.
So you're a student?
She's a graduate student at Clemson, and we've been collaborating. I decided we need to make this a collaboration then. Mm. I don't have a project, and you're assigned to me for these hours, so let's make it work together. And she wanted to work with children, so I was like, you know what? That sounds fascinating. I've never worked with children before. So let's do
something. Well, you were a high school teacher, though, right?
Yeah, but not elementary students. Oh, okay. So I should be more specific. I'm sorry.
Okay, so younger. She wanted to work with younger children.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I was like, okay, so we're going to work with elementary Latinx students. What are we doing? And to get back to my roots, you know, I revisited Anzaldúa. Mm. And that was just rereading that book, Borderlands, felt good. It felt really good to remind me of like, yeah, Napatla, that in-betweenness that we navigate, that uncertainty that we're always weighted on with, that we always have on us. Mm-hmm.
And the contradictions, like you can occupy, you know, two things can occupy space at once. Mm-hmm. I love how in many ways she defies the laws of physics for us, because she's like, the complexity is who we are. We will always be colonized or colonized. We will always be the both and, you know? And yeah, it's interesting. I feel like there's many people I talk to who found a lot of comfort in revisiting Anzaldúa, you know?
And it was just the right time to revisit it, because not only was I having this kind of identity crisis in regards to my profession, my work, and what is it all, what am I really trying to accomplish? Mm-hmm. But having the opportunity to, you know, also have the responsibility of, I'm working with a graduate student. I need to have something that will be productive and helpful. And, you know, I'm going to break this norm of like, this is my project and you're working on it, to like, let's collaborate and let's see what we can construct together.
Yeah.
And so we designed this pilot study where we were going to interview third to fifth grade Latinx students and just talk about their experiences in these predominantly white schools and ask them about like their race and how they're racialized, because they're racialized. I know Latinx is not a race, but it's
you're talking to someone who's made the argument that it is, right?
Right. Like, there's lots of us who have made this argument that it is a race. Yeah. In the social construct, like, we're not treated differently because, no, we're an ethnicity, guys. Calm down.
Right.
Like, we're still racialized. And so we really wanted to explore that a little bit. And I think we read your paper in Jumi.
Oh, thanks.
And that was a big inspiration in thinking about the power of talking to kids just explicitly about race, about language, and how does this influence your mathematics?
Yeah.
And so then we delved deeper. We read Solorzano, we did Yasso, we went all in and just spent a good 6 months reading, learning, and unlearning mm-hmm. kind of the pressures of academia and that it tells you not to do this stuff. Like,
yeah, it also tells us, many of us who come out of teaching have somehow learned to not trust mm-hmm. children to describe their own realities.
Right. And yeah. that's what I loved about LACRIT and that work is just it centralizes their story, mm-hmm. their testimonials, their counter stories as truth. Mm-hmm. Like, that's it. It is truth. End of story. Mm-hmm. Take that gift that they're giving you of their stories and use it to do good now. And I love that aspect of it. And I love the fact that we're working with children who can be both, who are just beautifully daring mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. about their stories. Because they, especially younger elementary students, third to fifth graders, they have nothing left to lose. They don't know how much they're really putting at risk by telling us these stories sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a wonderful kind of feeling to be able to have those conversations with students.
Mm-hmm. Because they are younger, I'm assuming you're also talking to parents, at least about how you're going to talk to students. So can you talk a little about the work of finding how you position yourself in relation to a community mm-hmm. that you have insider but also outsider-ness with?
Mm-hmm. So that was we struggled with this for a long time. We worked with the principals of some schools, and we actually approached this maybe in a kind of dangerous way, because we just worked through administratives, and they kind of put their reputation at risk. So they were the ones who went out and gave out consent forms. The administration was. We didn't, because we were just coming in, and the principals and the assistant principals were the ones who said, we can trust, you can trust us, let this group come in and talk mm-hmm. to your children.
So and they also were the ones doing the identifying of who is Latino then?
Yes.
Right, okay. Because I know that that's also always a sensitive issue in terms of, do somebody define you as Latino, or do you say, like, yeah, I am. Mm-hmm. I am that, you know. And people handle it differently. So it's interesting. Right. So the admin presumably had some kind of knowledge of the families that wasn't yes. superficial, stereotypical. Oh, their last name is...
right. You know, so they...
Yes, so they're probably Latino or something. Right. Yeah.
Right. No, they had access to the records to show, like, did they check the box? Mm-hmm. And then they went off of their own personal knowledge from there. So once they had kind of the list of, like, here are my students who have, at least their parents have identified them in the paperwork as, then, and there was a part of us that also wanted to explore the range. So maybe as expected, some of the issues that we had at first was every time we said, we want to talk to Latinx kids, they were like, well, here's our ELL coordinator's name.
Interesting, huh?
Which... I guess I should have anticipated, but uh-huh. I didn't. It was a little bit of a, that's not what I said. Uh-huh. And after some conversations, you know, we did break through. And we were able to interview a number of children after a couple of phone calls from concerned parents mm-hmm. as well. They were like, we got this from the principal, but we also have some questions for you. And I put my personal phone number on all the consent mm-hmm. forms for them to reach out to me if they had any questions. Mm-hmm. And I put on there in Spanish or English. Doesn't matter. Happy to have a conversation.
And you got calls? That's really great.
Oh, I got calls.
Parents.
I got calls. While...
Hello, why are you trying to talk to my child?
Yes.
Who are you? What are you going to do with this?
Right. What is this for? Who are you? I mean, all questions that I think were very valid. And they're definitely valid.
Yeah.
I took the time to answer each and every one of their questions as, you know, as best as I could without being mm-hmm. transparent. It's like, I'm trying to learn about the community and I wanted to learn about the schools through the perspective of your child. Mm-hmm. I don't want to go in and observe and make judgments about interactions, or I want to make mm-hmm. judgments about, like, well, this is what they're experiencing. I want to know from the mouth of babes.
Yeah.
What is happening? How are they experiencing it? And I really wanted to, again, centralize them mm-hmm. as the person who is the phenomena of their experience, the phenomenology yep. of it all.
So you've done interviews. Mm-hmm. Have you and Stacey published something?
Not yet. It's still really, really early in that stage. But it was, we have enough of preliminary results where we've presented a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And we were able to include some of those preliminary results in a submission to NSF for a DRK-12 career, which was accepted.
You got it funded.
It got funded.
Congratulations. Now, those grants, for people who don't know, are five-year, right? Five-year funding. So they're big grants. Mm-hmm. And they're to support you to really go deeply into some research that yeah. impacts the learning of STEM or something in the K-12 mm-hmm. system. So you got a grant funded that focuses on...
the experiences of upper elementary Latinx students, which...
how to talk about their lives and math and
right, learning and race, schooling and language.
Race and language.
It was one of those things where you just say, I'm going to try. This is the first year I was going to try for a career grant, so mm-hmm. I'm just going to try this. Even though from all my training, from all that you hear, it's purely qualitative. There's no quantitative. There was mm-hmm. nothing about scaling up. There was nothing about teachers. It was just purely about the students' experiences.
Yeah.
Everything that my training in academia tells me, this will not get funded.
Really?
Everything about this was telling me it was not going to get funded. Even the career cramp that Clemson offered, like really? The people giving feedback were like, are you... you sure?
They don't know the new crowd officers coming in.
Right. And I think...
yeah. But people, I feel like Karen King has ushered in. She's made the way, you know, yes. for more of the progressive lens mm-hmm. on what we really need to be asking about. And I think the funding just means that you had people who recognized this is what we need to be doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that's awesome.
Oh, the reviewers were incredible. Like... I wish I knew who they were just to thank them because yeah. they were, the reviews that they gave me were incredibly thoughtful, incredibly helpful in mm-hmm. just pushing forward this idea and really just motivating in regards to like, this does need to be done. And I was kind of shocked because it wasn't something that I really, again, like I said, the training that I received kind of pushed me to think that this would never mm-hmm. be something that would be funded in this particular way.
Right.
Yeah, it's it still feels surreal.
I guess. Well, go start talking to kids, it'll start to feel real.
it's a little surreal and daunting at the same time because of the population I'm working with, mm-hmm. because of the spaces that I'm looking at specifically, these predominantly white spaces. So these kids... mm-hmm. They're making up less than 20% of the school population, so uh-huh. they're very much in minoritized.
In general, in the South, the population yes. is
yeah.
I mean, because like we're at that point where people are saying like, you know, Latino communities are everywhere in the U.S. now.
Yeah,
so and where they're growing, there's rapid growth in the South. Okay.
Yeah, so there is a lot of South Carolina, Georgia, and that area is definitely the new destination states. Mm-hmm. Those are states that over the last couple of years have definitely had a significant for them, increase in Latinx and migrant mm-hmm. population. And so I think that definitely helped. But I think just the fact that it wasn't these predominantly white spaces and it wasn't focused necessarily on the ESOL aspect of it, mm-hmm. but instead kind of focusing on these Latinx students and their kind of experiences in regards to race mm-hmm. in school and language, that combination of those three things, I think was a really interesting space. I feel very pressured to do a really good job for the children, but mm-hmm. also because I recognize the weight of this particular kind of study. So mm-hmm. we'll see what happens.
Yeah. And I think that also that like that commitment and when you describe like the weight That reminds me a lot of in another episode when we were talking with Griselda, who's a high school teacher, right? And she's describing, like, she as a Latina also feels this tremendous pressure to do right by her her community or the kids she identifies with a lot who are her from Spanish-speaking homes, right? And so that feels like such a theme, you know, when we talk to educators, educational researchers, educational leaders who identify with the communities they're working with, in particular, I think communities of color, the weight is huge because we know the cost and we know the consequences, right? And you're also talking about like that need to protect, which I feel is another theme that's come up a lot in conversations that I've been in lately about like critical mathematics and, you know, trying to leverage online resources to share images of practice, but balancing that with a fear of exploiting children and families and how work will be taken up. And I just feel like that is, again, like an unspoken cognitive load, an emotional load. When you do this kind of work that, you know, to be frank, there's many mathematicians for whom that would not be what they're taking on. Right. And so I'm also curious, like, so there's this project that you're doing, but are you in the math department at Clemson?
I'm joint appointed, technically, but I'm 51-49. So all my tenure and all my reviews are in the College of Ed.
Okay.
But I'm joint appointed, so I can teach classes in the math department on a regular basis.
Oh, nice. So then you also teach, like, methods.
I teach classes. Both methods and content courses.
Nice.
Content in the math department, methods in the College of Ed.
So how do you imagine the research that you're doing transferring over to messages to teachers or engaging with teachers? Have you done some of that work?
Yeah, we've tried to present. We did present, not tried. We were scheduled to present on some of this at our state conference, and no one showed up. So that's what I meant. We tried to present.
Did you go ahead and do the presentation anyway?
No, we just left. We gave it the 15 minutes. Nobody showed up, and we left.
Which is the standard in educational spaces. So you have prepared. Yeah. Okay.
We are trying to figure out how do we use some of the work that we're doing. You know, these testimonials are not just data to collect and then to analyze. These testimonials also are powerful counter stories to to the expectations that we have. So part of the project is also asking them high cognitive demanding questions, specifically towards pattern tasks, growing patterns, and just showing that sometimes and being like, here's a student, fourth grader, generalizing this pattern task. She's ESOL services. She's receiving these services. And here she is. Tell me about her mathematical thinking. And just having that conversation with at least pre-service teachers has been really powerful because it's like these expectations that you have about ESOL learners not being able to do high cognitive demanding tasks because of their language, right? They have to develop language fluency before they can do these tasks.
Right.
Here's a counter story to that.
Right.
Here's something that now you can't tell me. Here's an existence proof. You can't tell me that anymore.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the power of these stories can really be. Even when they start talking about the relationship between like their race and language and math and how the language connects their community. Because I can do math at school, but because I speak Spanish, I can also do math at home with my mom. Like children recognizing that and then just letting them read that one little snippet, it really helps them reflect on how powerful that complete linguistic repertoire is for them. And I think that's where these stories can be very powerful for practicing and pre-service teachers. It's just...
Yeah, because it sounds like it's one thing to like read in the research or whatever, like provide a language-rich environment for your students, right? But if you haven't seen how that can really play out or you haven't learned to trust that idea, then and like you haven't connected it to a person,
right,
then you as a teacher might hesitate. You might be like, well, I'm not really sure that that's, and then when you read how a student is talking about it and see their math work that goes with it, yeah, I could see how that'd be very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering though, when we talk about the race piece, because I've noticed that sometimes even when we as racial experience scholars for Latinx communities, that we can sometimes allow the discussion to move to language, and language either then kind of stays at the forefront or a proxy mm-hmm. for race, and we drop the discussion about racism in the classroom.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious, does the context of the South provide another perspective on what is happening in terms of, you know, the history of, you know, locally how racism has played out?
Mm-hmm.
How might that, you know, show up in the stories of children and you know, mm-hmm. contribute to the counter stories?
So I think that's something we're still really trying to think deeply about. And one of the things that as I've been reading this, the Lat Crit literature and the critical race literature, context plays such an important role, and the history of that context plays such an important mm-hmm. role. Which is why in the career grant, and something that we immediately saw that we were lacking from just interviewing the children, was that context. So something that we built into the career grant, I say we because I've been working with Stacy mm-hmm. and another graduate student, Hillary, on this for so long, I just collaborated on this.
Right, and it's the NSF that limits the career right. grants to one PI. Yeah, right. Okay.
So that's why I keep saying we. But the particular first year is an oral history of the community. We wanted to really learn about the community's interpretation of what's happening here, what has happened here over the time, in order to almost replicating Danny Martin's first work, his 2000 book, mm-hmm. where he talked to community members about like mathematical socialization, mm-hmm. what is happening out in the community in regards to mathematics. We wanted to kind of take that same angle with the Latinx right. community there to really learn about what is their history to mm-hmm. get that rich context understanding before we even go into the schools.
Yeah.
So that way we have that rich oral history of a particular community and what may be the consequences of that, their understanding of the history that has occurred there.
Yeah. Yes, and I think if, for people who aren't as familiar, the Danny Martin work you're talking about, where when he was proposing that framework for African-American students' mathematics identities, he proposed these kind of concentric circles mm-hmm. where it was like, well, you have the person and their self-concepts in the middle, you have the immediate community, the school, you have the larger community outside the school that encompasses where the students live, and then you have like these even bigger discourses of what's happening. And yeah, so you're talking about gathering that local immediate knowledge right. that impacts. Yeah.
Right. Those larger spheres of influence
mm-hmm.
Before we even go directly to the schools to better just try to understand where these kids are coming from.
Mm-hmm.
To really understand that context of mm-hmm. the particular place. And I think that's been emphasized by many of our scholars in the field with, uh-huh. you know, community work, with learning about the pre-service teachers, learning about community. I mean, that's been emphasized for years.
Mm-hmm.
Just this morning, the mathematical modeling group was talking about, like, how do we use mathematics modeling to learn about community and learn about the richness of the community and so mm-hmm. forth. So all of these factors have been there and have been pushed on to do more of. So I think that was really something that we recognized was needed in order to really understand how these students are navigating these predominantly white spaces.
Nice.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to say? I'm just going to talk a lot about your work, your life.
I know.
Let me ask the question we've been asking people, which is the Todos has that initiative around like Todos for Agency, hashtag Todos for Agency. Like, so what do you think of when you think of agency?
Agency is, I've really been trying to wrap my head around it. It's because of the way that I think, I always think about storytelling in the stories that we're trying to tell and how we use these stories. So when I think of agency, it's really about how does the author of those stories think that the trajectories can go, if you will. Like, where can I go with the story that I'm writing? Are there particular ways that I know that I can't go this way with this story because I am going to assume something negative is going to happen? Mm-hmm. So as a story writer, as the author, what are the trajectories, opportunities that they themselves as the character of that story have? And agency, the more agency they have, the more openness to that, to whatever the story goes, mm-hmm. is available to them.
It reminds me of all that stuff from positioning theory about like storylines, right? Like, you don't know that other storylines exist. Mm-hmm. You'll never see yourself as a character in that storyline.
Right. Right.
It's really beautiful.
I try very hard.
Well, thank you so much, Nico. I appreciate it. Appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you once again to my guest, Nico Gomez. And we're really excited to see how your research turns out. Don't forget to join us this summer for the TOTOS conference in Scottsdale, Arizona. Sign up is now open also for the pre-conference workshop, which will be happening that Thursday before the conference kicks off. Everything is at our website, www.totos-math.org. And until I see you next time, I'll just remind you that the TOTOS podcast is a production of TOTOS Math for All. I want to thank Vector Hold for the music that you allow us to use week after week. And until the next podcast, seguimos luchando. Adios.